Night Live wins two terms. His book is humbly titled Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. He'll present this and more on Thursday, July 6th, 7 p.m. in Berkeley at King Middle School, 1781 Rose Street. Tickets at brownpapertickets.com and supportive bookstores.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So before I bring in our splendid guest, perfect for now, John Kiriakou, a few public service announcements, of a poignant nature. I will be embarking on my Stella Coyote Memorial Summer Solstice Tour, Coyote as Keeper of Democracy, because my beloved coyote companion Stella died on Monday at 1 p.m. after 19 years of teaching and being an ambassador from her people that we may have trickster medicine to keep democracy alive. Ah, may it be so. She taught me a lot about the distinction between grief and sentimentality, going, no, you know, that tragedy wants to increase our desire to live, and very often admiration trumps aggravation. When I go, wow, you aided you created a door in the wall where there was none. Very impressive. Great ambassador between worlds, that our rogue species may treat her people with kindness, honoring coyote quality of indigenuity as necessary for our species to rejoin the choreography of creation, because there's nothing smarter, really, in nature. So on Saturday, June 17th, in Owings Mills, Maryland, I'll be part of Inspiration Community Summer Solstice Celebration. You can find out more about that at coyotenetworknews.com. And on June 21st, I will be out, yes, in the motherland, at Open Secret in San Rafael with Amichaela Gaston. Also, June 23rd, 6 p.m., at Commonweal in Bolinas. That's High John Eve, the holiest night in all of New Orleans. When Marie Laveau and High John walk the streets, I'll be providing astro-mytho-political guiding meta-narrative that a renaissance of reverent ingenuity, fueled by sane reverence, may emerge from the composting of tyranny, with Amichaela Gaston calling in the spirits, because we need all the help we can get. So, more than perfectly, as we dive to the dark of the moon and the summer solstice, which is traditionally when that which has been falsely estranged is married again, like democracy and truth and those things. So we are airing deep, dark delving in conversational vernacular, welcoming whistleblower John Kiriakou, author of Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison, the prison to which they sent him. His website is johnkiriakou.com. That's John, and then Kiriakou.com. He's a former CIA counterterrorism officer, a former senior investigator with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee under John Kerry. He became the sixth whistleblower indicted by the Obama administration under the Espionage Act, a law designed to punish spies. He served 23 months in prison as a result of his attempts to oppose the Bush administration's torture program. Welcome, John.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
That's great. So there's so many places to go, but I did want to start off. And you were presented the 2016 Sam Adams Award for Integrity, wonderful. But I did want to start off also with Reality Winner. I was reading your piece on her, and this theme of whistleblowers, because not only is her name fabulous, you know, Reality Winner indicted, you know, but you have a lot to say. I so treasure your nuance, your narrative nuance in guiding us through many things. We'll get to Comey as well, but let's start off with Reality Winner and The Intercept and what you might want to say about all of that.
Oh, I feel like I have maybe even too much to say about Reality Winner and The Intercept. First of all, let's look at the difference between whistleblowing and leaking. Whistleblowing is defined legally in the U.S. Code as bringing to light any evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. And leaking is just leaking. Leakers leak information for a wide variety of reasons. They like the thrill. They do it for revenge. They like to make themselves feel important. They enjoy the contact with the press. But for whistleblowing, there's an element of public good. You're revealing this information in the public interest. But the problem there is that even though we have a Whistleblower Protection Act here in the United States, national security whistleblowers are exempt from its protections. And so if you work for the CIA, NSA, FBI, DOD, Homeland Security, what have you, and you reveal evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, you're buying yourself an Espionage Act charge. There's no legal protection for you. And so there's really nowhere to go. You know, they tell us when we first join these sensitive organizations in government that if you do witness something illegal or unethical, you go through your chain of command. And then if you don't get satisfaction from your chain of command, you go to the congressional oversight committees. But during the Obama administration, that's exactly what people like Tom Drake and Jeffrey Sterling did. And they still ended up with Espionage Act charges. Tom Drake was charged with 9 felonies, including 7 counts of espionage, for telling the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence that NSA was spying on American citizens. In my case, it was my chain of command that created the CIA's torture program, and so my only alternative was to go to the press. Reality Winner, and this is also, I think, an important point, Reality Winner revealed an NSA document. It was an analytic document, so it contained no sources and methods, but was in the public interest. With that said, at her trial, or at least in the run-up to her trial, she will be forbidden from saying that what she did was in the public interest, only because the law does not cover people like her.
Hmm. Right. But of course, to us, we're grateful for this
right.
Essential piece of news about how much the Russians were hacking into not only voting machines and lists and all kinds of stuff, going, no, it's a service to democracy, which is also what you said in your article. Yeah. And then because we do want nuance, you know, again, we are all, you know, aspiring to spiral out of polarity, this good, this bad, we go, no, it's very complex. And you do take on The Intercept. You said The Intercept should be ashamed of itself, and Matthew Cole burns yet another source. In your article, what Reality Winner did was heroic. Well, let's apply nuance to, you know, we often think of The Intercept as our team, right?
Right.
Here comes your nuance and perspicacity as a guide. Yeah, thank you.
Well, I love The Intercept. I went to college with Glenn Greenwald. I thought that the whole idea behind The Intercept was a terrific one. Pierre Omidyar has deep pockets, and we needed somebody with deep pockets to be able to finance something like this to get our side of the story out, to get our side of the news out. So I thought the idea was a brilliant one. And I know that they've had sort of fits and starts as they've gotten established in the media, and that's fine. Where I take very grave exception with The Intercept is with the hiring of Matthew Cole. I met Matthew Cole in 2008. He was a would-be author. In fact, he identified himself to me very specifically as not a journalist, but an author, and said that he was writing a book on the CIA's rendition program. Could I introduce him to somebody who might be willing to sit for an interview? I said, when I was at the CIA, rendition wasn't my thing. I didn't know anything about kidnapping. I can't help you. So he sent me a list of about a dozen names, and he said, can you introduce me to any of these people? I didn't know any of the names. He sent me a second list of a dozen names, and finally I said, look, you obviously know this issue so much better than I do. I really can't help you. And so he finally said, well, what about this guy, John, that you mention in your first book? And I said, without thinking, oh, you're talking about John Doe. I don't know whatever happened to him. He's probably retired and living somewhere in Northern Virginia. Well, that response was a felony, because what I had done is I had confirmed the name of a former colleague. Now, that happens in Washington every single day, and nobody's ever prosecuted for it. But the government had that information, and they held it in reserve. Well, the way things turned out, and in the meantime, Matthew Cole had gone to ABC News, the way things turned out is that Matthew Cole was never working on a book. That was a lie. It was a cover story. He was actually secretly working as an investigator for the Guantanamo defense attorneys. So when he got the name from me, he sent it to another investigator who then sent it to the defense attorneys. The defense attorneys put the name in a classified sealed motion and sent it to the judge. When the judge read it, he recognized it as classified information and reported it to the FBI. So the FBI got a warrant for the attorney's emails, traced it to the investigator, traced that email to Matthew Cole, and then the rest is unclear, because Matthew Cole has never said one way or the other. If the government hacked into his emails, he was by then a working journalist, or if he cooperated against me with the FBI. So he's never said. I've asked, and I've never gotten a satisfactory answer, but the bottom line is that I went to prison for 23 months because of that conversation with Matthew Cole. He did nothing to protect my identity. Now, fast forward all these years later, 9 years later, Matthew Cole is the recipient of an email and of a classified report from Reality Winner. And what does he do? He takes a copy of the report, gives it to an NSA source of his, allegedly, or a contact of his at NSA, and the NSA contact immediately goes to the FBI and reports it. Reality Winner is arrested 1 hour after the publication of the article. Now, how could the FBI get her so quickly? I'll tell you, because everybody in Washington knows that NSA puts microscopic identifiers on each printed page. So if I work for NSA and I print a document, microscopically it will say on that page, printed by John Kiriakou. Well, all they had to do was look at the page that Matthew Cole had handed over to them. Now, if Matthew Cole is the national security journalism expert that he professes to be, he should have known that that identifier was on that page, and he should never have engaged directly with NSA. Richard Esposito, who is a co-author of the report, knows even better. He's been working the national security beat for the last 25 years with ABC, with NBC, in radio. He knows better than that. Now, to me, that is just shoddy journalism. And this is going to be the second person that's going to go to prison now because Matthew Cole can't do his job.
And just on a poignant level, you know, when we look at Reality Winner, and that is her real name, she's 23 years old, Air Force, former Air Force. All the pictures out there are her hugging her dog and her cat. I'm like, no, I want her home. I want her home with her dog and her cat.
Exactly.
I mean, what a sympathetic heroine. And we're grateful. We're grateful. And in this climate, you know, to tease more of your nuance, because that we all cultivate complex capacity to hold many stories at once, and we'll get to Comey in a moment. But, you know, so when Reality Winner was indicted, and it's like a mythic news headline, you know, all the people on MSNBC that we've been sort of snookered into counting on, in, you know, Malcolm Nance, you know, all these,
right,
all these kind of, you know, they all go, oh no, well, the terrible thing is she did, we should go to prison. And it's like, okay, we like, you know, one half drop of what, of stories they have to contribute, but here they are revealed as not really our allies in this realm, right?
You're right, and don't forget that the only side of the story we have about Reality Winner is what the federal government has released in the indictment report and in the arrest report. So it's stunning to me that so many journalists, especially journalists on the left who really ought to know better, are just taking the government's word for it. I can tell you from firsthand experience that they lie. They lie and they will, I'll give you an example. When I was arrested, in the report released by the FBI, they said that I had said all these incredibly terrible things. I don't even remember specifically. They were outrageous, and they made me look like I really deserved to die in a federal penitentiary. And my wife said to me, "You didn't actually say this stuff, did you?" And I said, "No." Well, I said, "Yeah," like in a dozen different emails. But they just took individual sentences out of these different emails and put them together in one paragraph and made me look like I was some kind of a rogue. And that's what they're doing to her. Another thing that really bothers me, and this is something that no journalist has yet asked, is why in the world is this woman still in jail? Why is she still in pretrial detention? She should have been released on her own recognizance. All the rest of us have been. Why are they holding her when the only thing she's being accused of having done is to send this overclassified report to a journalist? Again, a report that had no sources and methods and caused no damage to the national security.
Right. So there's a fantastic series on MHZ called the Weizensee Saga about the Stasi, who were, you know, and it's amazing to think that they were ruling really till 1989. Oh my God. But, you know, and compared to that, you know, it's a kind of medium amateur tyranny over here, kind of. But maybe you can disabuse us of that, you know. But exactly what you're saying, the level of lies and chicanery and up to no goodness, and even when you went to prison, you were like, it's the camp, right? No, you're going to real prison. Oh, wait a minute, right? And your lawyer said, well, we could protest against it, but it would take 2 years and you'll be out by then. And it's right? So you learned to metabolize conniption fits, right? Did you?
Yes. It's funny to hear you say it that way. I mean, it's funny to me now, but it wasn't funny in February of 2013. Yeah, you're right. See, that's all part of the game. The government has been doing this for so long, and they do it every single day. And when you're arrested, your whole world is falling apart, and you don't know what to expect. And you have to understand that there's this huge team of people working for the sole purpose of putting you in prison for as long as they possibly can. You don't know what they're doing, you don't know what they have, you don't know what they're planning, and you find yourself being reactive rather than proactive. And so it's very, very difficult. Besides the fact that you're so profoundly depressed, you don't know what you're going to do to yourself. So the FBI and the Justice Department have these little tricks. One is called venue shopping. So they will... they will seek to charge you in the federal district where they're going to get the most hostile judge to you and where you're likely to get the longest sentence. I'll give you an example. Poor Jeffrey Sterling. Jeffrey Sterling was a CIA officer who filed a racial discrimination suit against the agency. The agency did not dispute the fact that they had discriminated against him because he's African American. What they said was that they couldn't defend themselves because to do so would require them to reveal classified information. And so the judge threw the case out. Well, they immediately began looking at Jeffrey, and they accused him of having leaked information to the New York Times. Jeffrey was living in St. Louis, which is the Eastern District of Missouri. He was accused of cooperating with Jim Risen at the New York Times. Risen lives in Bethesda, Maryland, which is the Federal District of Maryland, and he works in Washington, which is the Federal District of the District of Columbia. The New York Times, of course, is in the Southern District of New York. But Jeffrey Sterling was charged in the Eastern District of Virginia, which is also called the espionage court, because no national security defendant has ever won a case there. I was charged in the Eastern District of Virginia, and Ed Snowden has been charged in the Eastern District of Virginia, and we all three have the same judge, Judge Leonie Brinkema. She's a hanging judge. So that's one thing that they do, is this venue shopping. The other thing is called charge stacking, and this is even more dangerous for a defendant. Let's say maybe you have committed a crime. Maybe you haven't, but maybe you have. They won't just charge you with that one crime. They'll charge you with 5, 10, 20 felonies, and they'll make you defend yourself. And then right as you go bankrupt, they'll come back and say, all right, take a plea to this one charge, and we'll dismiss all the other charges. So what do you do? In my case, I was facing 5 felonies, including 3 counts of espionage. I had not committed espionage, and I'll get to that in a second. They knew I hadn't committed espionage, but I had already spent over $1 million on my defense, $1 million that I didn't have. I still owe my attorneys $880,000. And so finally the Justice Department came back and said, all right, we'll drop 4 of the 5 charges if you plead to violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. So instead of 45 years in prison, I'm looking at 23 months. Well, what do you do? It's an economic decision. One of my attorneys said, this can be a blip in your life, or it can be the defining event of your life. Make it the blip. And so I took the deal. I knew in my heart that I was innocent, but it becomes an issue of damage control. You know, when we received discovery from the Justice Department, we found these 3 incredible memos. There was a memo from the CIA to the Justice Department saying, charge him with espionage. And then the Justice Department responded and said, but he hasn't committed espionage. And then the CIA wrote back and said, charge him anyway and make him defend himself. And that's exactly what they did. And I suspect that's what they're going to do to Reality Winner.
Ha! And then we want to turn to, you know, what we can do. But as you delineate in your really great book, Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. This is our great guest, John Kiriakou. All of this was a kind of petty revenge, long brewing by the CIA.
Yeah.
This immature, because you had said that Abu Zubaydah had been tortured, right?
That was it. That was the entire basis of this whole case.
Wow. And you are, you know, quite an extraordinarily cultivated person. You speak Greek, you speak Arabic, you know, it's amazing. But you spoke, you know, with him conversationally, Zubaydah, in Arabic about philosophy and things. And then he was subject to this horrific round of tied up in cold water and no sleep for weeks and
right.
23 waterboardings and all that. And that's what you said. And the CIA, like some peevish, demonic 12-year-old carried this grudge, really, against you.
Yeah.
There's no integrity or principle in this, is there? I mean,
there was really nothing behind it, but fury at my having aired the CIA's dirty laundry in public.
Yeah,
They were so angry, and the funny thing is, you know, I gave this interview to ABC News in December of 2007, in which I said 3 important things that changed the course of the rest of my life. I said that the CIA was torturing its prisoners. I said that torture was official U.S. government policy. It was not the result of a rogue, as President Bush had said. And I said that President Bush had personally authorized the torture program. So the FBI began investigating me the very next day. Again, this was December of 2007. And they investigated me for a full year until December of 2008. And then they determined that I had not committed a crime, and they closed the case. So 3 weeks later, President Obama is inaugurated. And I had no idea that the CIA had secretly gone to the Obama White House and asked them to reopen the case against me, which they did. I had no idea that my phones were tapped, that my emails were being intercepted, and that I had FBI surveillance teams following me. And they investigated me for 3 more years. And then in January of 2012, 3.5 years after this conversation with Matthew Cole, I was charged with these 5 felonies.
Yeah, so it is a quirky, long beat down this petty revenge theme. And again, we want the complex nuance, even just the CIA, at which you were very happy to work. It gave you structure. It was exciting.
Oh, yeah.
It refers to many things. And, you know, so what we share, here we are. You're in Northern Virginia. I'm across the river, you know, but we're kind of close to the CIA headquarters. Hello there.
Right.
You know, I grew up surrounded by people CIA-ish, not that my family approved, but we were sort of in that realm. I went to my 3rd grade classmate was Anne Roosevelt, daughter of Kermit, right? Right. And I had an inkling, because I remember vividly saying to her in 3rd grade, your father, Kermit Roosevelt, reminds me of a large rabbit in a bathrobe with a gun, And it's like, I got it, because he was a wimpy, petty person.
He single-handedly overthrew the Iranian government.
with $40,000, you know, and right. A second try, just destabilizing, hiring thugs to beat up newspaper, you know, I mean, just, it's all that. And then I do remember, and I'll toss it right back to you, but, you know, I'm youngest of five, so my older brother was studying Russian, and so he was being recruited. This was your job, we'll spiral around that, by the CIA. And in third grade, I remember telling my classmates that, going, the CIA tried to recruit my brother. And some little officious third grader came up to me and said, you're not supposed to talk about that. And I go, I'm third grade, in third bleeping grade, my God. But yes, you were a recruiter, and you, like Carl Jung, are a Leo, the Sun square Neptune, which is a lifelong what is real and what is not real, and illusion and delusion, and these mysteries. And you yourself, you know, in a realm of colleagues with lies-ish, you know, and ambiguity, presenting one thing, but, you know, and so the recruiting, and this was part of your skill set in prison, apparently, which we can tease into. So this realm of you know, lies and spooks, and then you got to a point. And it was the torture, right, where you just... Where you
it, it was. It was the torture. And not just the torture, but the secret prisons. And, you know, the thing is, on your very first day, not just at the CIA, but anywhere in government, you stand up, you raise your right hand, and you solemnly swear to protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I took that oath very seriously. I am a very firm and strong believer in the Constitution of the United States. We have laws. We're a nation of laws. And whether we like them or not, whether we like the other guy's politics or not, we have to abide by those laws. Well, just because September 11th hits doesn't mean that we throw the Constitution out the window. We like to tell the rest of the world that we are this shining beacon of democracy and respect for human rights and civil liberties. And we're frankly not. We ought to be, but we're not. And so when we started torturing people at these secret sites, in clear violation of the United Nations Conventions Against Torture, in clear violation of the 1946 Federal Torture Act, it was just wrong. And it didn't matter if Two Towers came down in New York. It was still wrong.
Right. I also, like, I mean, people say, you know, living in a 9/11, post-9/11 world, and some people on Twitter say, we're living in a post-11/9 world. And, you say Trump is equal to Obama, and I want to come back to this, because I sometimes give my dedicated listeners, hi there, conniption fits by saying, yes, you know, Obama has done sketchy things, yes, the drone's terrible, yes, the whistleblowing terrible, you know, but I think he's the most intelligent, reflective, interesting president we're probably ever going to have, and then the left wing goes, ah, he's a terrible person. But it is a puzzle, you know, what quality of prison do you think the presidency is that he would do such things, the persecution of whistleblowers very aggressively, Tom Drake, you know, Jeffrey Sterling. What's your own why about that, this pretty reflective, decent man?
Well, I think that we've actually seen this in the past with previous presidents, too. One of the things that the CIA is very, very good at, and that is co-opting. I use the word recruiting new presidents, especially presidents who have very little experience with foreign policy or with intelligence policy. You know, Barack Obama was supposed to be this great thinker, constitutional scholar. He was fresh. He was new. He was smart. But as soon as he reads his first blue border report or black border report at six levels above top secret, as soon as his CIA briefers say, Mr. President-elect, we want to brief you on the cool and exciting things that we are doing all over the world, they've hooked him and they've reeled him in. And it's not just presidents, it's directors too, like Leon Panetta. You know, Leon Panetta, if you recall, was supposed to go into the CIA in 2009 and clean the place up. And instead, he jumped in with both feet, and they just sucked him right in.
All right, hold that important thought. We're going to have a very short Taj Mahal musical break, and we'll be right back, and we'll address Comey and more on your book, and how do we survive, and how do we follow Edward Snowden's advice. Our perfect for today guest, and forever, really, is John Kiriakou, author of Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison, and we'll be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellation that dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellation that dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasar and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Chiny, chiny, come blow my chiny home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, our skookum, connected to the spirits, completely competent for the work at hand. Guest is John Kiriakou. And just briefly, I may see many of you on Wednesday, June 21st, 7 p.m., Open Secret in San Rafael. It is my Stella Coyote Summer Solstice Memorial Tour, as the great ally Coyote Ambassador Between Worlds has departed. It's a huge thing for me. Anyway, so we'll be honoring that. That's June 21st, 7 p.m. at Open Secret in San Rafael with Emma Kayla Gaston, wonderful longtime collaborator. And June 23rd, 6 p.m., Commonweal in Bolinas, High John Eve, the holiest night in all of New Orleans. I will be providing the mythopolitical guiding meta-narrative for the solstice with Emma Kayla Gaston calling in the spirits, because we need experiment. We need all the help we can get now to, perpetuate democracy and save as much life as we can. All right, now back to your splendid self, John Kiriakou. we were right on. CIA guy who got recruited, snookered, was started off with some ideals. Well, this is also how the CIA started, right? I have strange connections to Mary Meyer, who was JFK's lover. Yeah, no, we'll have to keep these conversations going. I hope this is the first of many, many earrings and hosting you. No, I'm deeply intertwined with Mary Meyer, and the whole history of the CIA and how CIA guys marry artists, right, so they can marry Venus and continue their Mars work. It's it's like generals love hippies. And it's all a complex Washington soup. But in that realm, and my brother's former father-in-law was Tracy Barnes. The leader of the enormous fiasco in Cuba for the CIA. These are demonic people, but they love their dogs, But anyway, it's all so. But the CIA does start, in its origins. It's these fresh, Ivy League privileged guys out of World War II who do want to do good. It's world federalists, world peace, right? And then the sinister people come along, going, "Oh yes, what a good idea." But if you really want to do it, then any means necessary, and we'll let you into the boys' club. That's just what you were saying about Obama.
Right.
And there we go. So it does seem that part of your dedicated narrative is how do good ideals get snookered and imprisoned and conned, and how do people con themselves? Maybe like you're saying, Obama going, "We'll let you into the big boys' club, and look what we're doing, and this is how grown-ups deal." Is that kind of what you were saying?
Yeah, that is kind of what I'm saying. And let me give you another little anecdote, too. After I left the CIA, I went to one of the big four accounting firms. I went to Deloitte & Touche. And great job on the boring side, but very smart people. Everybody's an accountant, right? And one of the things that I learned, and it's not just in Deloitte & Touche, but in society in general, and also, in government outside the intelligence community, is that everybody wishes he was a CIA guy. Everybody. I don't care how much money you're making. I don't care how great your job is or how big your house is. Everybody always looks back and says, "Boy, I wish I had gone into the CIA." Well, presidents are like that, too.
Wait, who are these people again?
Well, yeah, I'm your average run-of-the-mill CPA. I'll give you an example. I was traveling with Deloitte & Touche. I went to Memphis to meet with an accountant there. And we got to chatting over lunch. And here's a guy, 5 years younger than I am, and he's making $1.2 million a year, just doing other people's tax returns. He's making $1.2 million. And I said, geez, man, I had no idea you guys did so well on an individual basis. And he said, I'd give it all up if I could have been in the CIA. And I found that to be consistent everywhere. In Washington, outside of Washington, and it's the same thing with presidents and with congressmen and power players in Washington. If they could do it, they would give it up and go to the CIA just for the excitement and the intrigue. And you know, people watch these movies, the James Bond and Jason Bourne, and they think that that's real life in the CIA, and that they have missed out on that excitement. And so once you get into a position where you're going to be invited into the club, like Obama was in 2009 and Panetta was in 2009, you jump at it. And here you thought you were going to be a reformer. You thought you were going to change the place and change its culture. And instead, the culture changed you in a matter of months. And that's the norm.
Right. So I mean, there's so much in your narrative. Again, you know, all powerful stories guide us to all powerful stories. You know, this, yes, Walter Mitty fantasy, and yes, and even the Bourne was part of the questioning of Sessions. Do you like Jason Bourne Conniption fits more? But this all, you know, we start off at, you know, at Skull and Bones in Yale, where they actually do a ritual to kill feeling and empathy. They say this sense of feeling and empathy is weakness, and I kill it now. And then, you know, the Dementors go, well, we'll give you financial and political power. There you go. And,
you know, and
what
I'll tell
saying,
you something yeah. along those very same lines. A CIA psychiatrist told me one time that the CIA seeks to actively recruit people who have sociopathic tendencies. They don't like to recruit sociopaths, though, because sociopaths have no ability to feel empathy, and they have no conscience, and they're very easy. They very easily pass polygraph tests, but they're hard to control. People who have sociopathic tendencies do have a conscience, do feel some empathy, but are happy to break the law if it's for the common good. And I'll give you an example. When I was being interviewed for my job at the CIA, one of the psychiatrists asked me this question. He said, let's say that you've been tasked with recruiting a certain individual overseas because you know that he has something in his office that you need, a file, a computer disk, whatever. You need it. So you begin developing this individual, and you take him to dinner, and you end up becoming friends, and you go on vacation together, and your spouses are become friends. But you determine after about a year that this guy just is not recruitable. So what do? And I said, you break into the office and steal it. And he said, that's exactly what you do. Now, that's a sociopathic tendency. A normal person would not immediately jump to the conclusion that you need to break into this poor guy's office and steal something from him. But if it's what the American government needs to protect Americans or to protect American installations or whatever, you're going to do it. Well, sociopaths easily slip through the cracks of these exams and these tests and these vetting processes. And so you end up with a cadre of leadership at the agency that has to be restrained and that has to be reined in, because given their own devices, they just won't stop. It's their nature.
Right. And you also narrate dinners at which everybody's lying. Everybody's got an undercover. Everybody's lying, and it takes everybody a while to figure out, like, oh, I was trying to recruit you. You were trying to recruit me, or actually, you were an FBI guy, but pretending to be a Japanese intelligence agent. And you go, oh, wow, did you dive into the underworld? And you mention in the book, you know, this is a segue from what you just said. That navigating in gray areas was something you said that allowed you to survive prison, right?
It really did.
But also, Yeah, well, we do want to get to that. But first, and as a gray area, I do want to just touch on your nuance and perspicacity and guiding us into James Comey, that you say you chuckled when he's referred to as a whistleblower. And then whistleblowers bring to light evidence of waste, fraud, and abuse. And also, Mueller. So yes, anything we need to know now just to have to wish the best of them to come forth, but being fully savvy and not snookered, right? Well, yeah, however you want to guide us.
That's it. You know, this is so complicated for me. I have so many mixed emotions about these guys, about both Comey and Mueller. I feel a little bit more strongly about Mueller because it was Mueller who established what was called the John Kiriakou Task Force at the FBI in order to see to it that I spent the rest of my natural years in prison. So I have much
Well, what do you think his what was his? I mean, if the CIA had this petty revenge of a demented infantile person, what was Mueller's motive?
Well, the motive was he was just doing what he was told to do. We knew from discovery that this was all being driven by John Brennan at the NSC. This is before Brennan went back over to the agency as director. John and I went back to 1990 together, and he didn't like me, and I didn't like him. And so Brennan was really the driving force behind my prosecution. It was Brennan, actually, that denied one of my attorneys a security clearance, saying Kiriakou's attorneys have enough security clearances, they don't need any more. And when we received this from the prosecution, it said, the White House said that Kiriakou has enough cleared attorneys. Well, first of all, who at the White House said that? Secondly, why in the world is the White House interfering in my case?
And this was
so I have the White House that's... Yeah, so they backed off. Right. Well, that tipped us off that it was John Brennan. And finally, they backed off. But... yeah, Mueller was doing as he was told to do, which is very disappointing to me. Now, Comey, this is really the interesting thing for me.
I just want to underline that what you're saying is Mueller's foible there is obedience.
Obedience. Yeah, okay. And, you know, that's a very common trait over at the FBI. They really aren't free thinkers at the FBI as much as they are at the agency. Now, at the agency, they're too free in their thinking, and they end up becoming cowboys and doing things, crazy things all over the world, like, you know, killing people and overthrowing governments. But at the FBI, it's exactly the opposite, where they just simply do as they're told, whether it's right or wrong.
Yes. All right, no, and I apologize. I interrupted you. You were going to go...
No, not at all. I was saying about Comey. You know, Comey really does fit the legal definition of a whistleblower. He really did bring to light evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, and illegality in that in that hearing last week. But the reason I'm chuckling is the son of a gun also had a friend of his leak the report to the Washington Post. Now, the report was not classified, and so... The president calling him a leaker, well, yeah, technically he's a leaker, I suppose, in that he didn't just do it himself or give an interview to the press on the record. He had a friend of his leak the report to the Post. But he really does fit that definition of a whistleblower. And so this is kind of a new role for Comey. I think this is something we ought to watch very closely. I'm hard-pressed to think of another episode like this since Watergate, where we're watching these giants of Washington, these titans of government, and they're all hunkering down and trying to figure out how to protect themselves. Remember, it's almost never the crime that gets them. It's the cover-up of the crime. And so Mueller has the ability now to start throwing around charges, what are generally called throwaway charges, that's why I use the term throwing around, like making a false statement, obstruction of justice, perjury. You know, these are charges meant to be dismissed later. These are bargaining chip charges. So if Watergate is any lesson, if the Scooter Libby case is any lesson, I think this investigation is going to go for another couple of years, and in the end, 3, 4, 5, 6 people are going to face indictments, and none of these indictments are going to be terribly serious charges, and none of them are going to end up having something to do with Russia.
Oh, phooey. So you think we're stuck with this guy. I just want to bring in a little bit of nuanced mythology going, you know, we discourage the bad, we encourage the good, you know, in everybody, you know, and multiple layers. And so there are metaphors for each degree of the zodiac. And the image for Comey's son, S-U-N, is the crown and torch of the Statue of Liberty, the necessity to defend democracy from tyranny. And I go, well, maybe it's his mystery play moment. And the image for his Venus is a performer in a ritual mystery play. And I go, all right, I'm talking to that part of that guy, you know, sketchy as everything else is. But also, if you were Comey, wouldn't you have leaked your memo?
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, yeah, holy
Again,
moly.
It's every man for himself. And
well, yeah, and just, you know, yes, in for befoibled reasons, but also just to have a, you know, a truthful narrative out there going, wait a minute.
That's right. I'm going to compare this to my own situation. My wife gave me some really great advice when I was convicted. She said that I needed to embrace this, that I needed to keep talking about it at every opportunity, because eventually the Justice Department, she said, is going to move on to the next person, which they did. It was Ed Snowden. And they're going to stop talking about you. But if you keep talking, if you keep getting the truth out there, it's the truth that becomes the record. And she was right.
What a great wife. Yay,
great
yay
wife.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well done. And did you see Katie Couric's interview with Edward Snowden in Moscow?
I did.
I thought it was not her, she was annoying, but he was fabulous. and such a gracious, earned, interesting narrator. And I liked it when she kept saying, aren't you frightened, aren't you frightened, shouldn't we be frightened? And he said with this great composure, no, we shouldn't be frightened. We should be ready.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I admire him. I mean,
I do too. I think he's so wise beyond his years.
He's earned this.
He really has.
And he also has a great girlfriend.
He has a great and loving girlfriend.
Yeah.
He's very fortunate. I mean,
yeah, she like you had a great wife. Edward Snowden has a great girl. You know, it's like all right, that's good. There's some positive equal Mars and Venus to measure out the insane kind of warlords marrying hippie artists. And then as you mentioned, yeah, with Jason Bourne and everything. But did you ever watch Mission Impossible?
Oh, I loved it. I've seen every episode.
Right. Dun, 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 dun. It's very rousing, right? But basically what it was, you know, and it was every episode, that is impressive. But basically what it was Latin American government leaning to the left, eliminate them. I mean, right, we were being snookered in already, dun, 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 you know, because we want a team. I mean, we all want a team. It's why people watch NCIS, for God's sake, or CSI, the original with Grissom.
Right.
But we want a team, and that is what you found an embrace of, in a sense, when you first joined the CIA. It was like, this is a team. It's like training camp. We're learning things. We have disguises, you know, and then, uh-oh, right? So, I mean, but we do want a team.
Right.
I just wanted to bring up 7 Days in May, a movie you perhaps also know.
Oh, yes.
Right. I think it really holds up crucially, importantly now, and something for us to kind of vitalize, because it's a great narrative. It was JFK's favorite novel. There comes a point, it's sort of like water saturated with salt, where you just add one little grain and everything falls out of solution, where the people involved in the coup, you know, at a certain point, they go, I can't go further, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm rooting for that, because you, Tom Drake, I had dinner with Tom Drake, and I don't know if you were there, but it was a bunch of NSA whistleblowers, and they were in the NSA for 40 years, you know, and then they were like, after 40 years, that's enough, right? So everybody's got their moment. You had the moment when it was torture, you know.
I'll never forget it. I'll never forget the conversation that turned me all around. I had come back from Pakistan in May of 2002. I had been the chief of counterterrorism operations in Pakistan for the CIA post 9/11. And I came back right after the Abu Zubaydah capture, and I went to the cafeteria to get a sandwich. And a senior counterterrorism center officer stopped me in the cafeteria and said, "Hey, I'm glad I ran into you. I wanted to ask you, do you want to be certified in the use of enhanced interrogation techniques?" And I had never heard that term before. And I said, "What's that mean?" And very excitedly, he said, "We're going to start getting rough with these guys." well, what does that mean? And then he described these 10 techniques, and I said, hey, that sounds like a torture program. What in the world are you guys talking about? And they asked 14 people if they wanted to go through the training. I was the only one who said no. And then, interestingly enough, here I am. I just captured the guy who we thought was the number three in Al-Qaeda. I go back to headquarters, and because I turned down the torture training, my promotion panel passed me over for promotion, and in the written feedback, they said, and these were their exact words, they said that I had displayed a shocking lack of commitment to counterterrorism.
Whoa. Right.
Crazy.
Because the whole torture thing, it's so psychiatrically kinky. I mean, it's so sadomasochistic with a really sketchy undercurrent of bad sex and dominance, you know, and the dominator virus, you know. So that was your moment. That's an important moment. Tom Drake had his moment. And other noble people and Reality Winner did what she was. Well, she was an NSA, you know, contractor. So we don't know. But everybody, you know. So it's kind of a blessing. We want to spiral forth. May everybody have their moment, like in 7 days in May, where you go, I've done terrible things, you know, for 40 years or for 10 years or for a minute. But that's enough. You know, it's the theme of detective novels where you recruit. I want to cut back to recruiting in prison here, where you recruit the up-to-no-good person, because even back to 234 BC in China, yep. The detective novels say, you know, the detective journeys through the underworld and bad people come up going, I was going to kill you or harm you, but I sense that you're authentic, which is a new ingredient in this mix here. So I want to join your team, but I have underworld skills you will need. Now, We do want underworld skills. I mean, we want the good team to have great hackers and you know, and your skill set, you know, but dedicated to, you know, something, you know, good over here. So, I don't know. I mean, could we waft out? You know, do you think there's an increasing climate that you also kind of embody and your beautiful wife and, you know, going, may everybody, but here's the beatdown, right, with Reality Winner. It's like, you know, do you want to leave your dog, your cat, your family, and go to, you know, whoa. All right, so what's your counsel, John Kiriakou? We want a climate of embrace. Is there such a thing rising? I mean, there's the opposite rising.
Well, I think there is, but I think it's incremental. And I think where we've seen it most clearly, frankly, is in the House of Representatives, where there are elements of the Patriot Act that all of a sudden are not so popular in the House of Representatives anymore. And indeed, several of the tenets of the Patriot Act have fallen by the wayside because they lacked support in the House. So in terms of legislation, I'm seeing a little bit of change. On the Senate side, there are a couple of senators who have really been supportive of whistleblowers. Ironically, they're mostly Republicans. People like Chuck Grassley of Iowa, Rand Paul of Kentucky, Pat Leahy's been okay, a Democrat from Vermont. Ron Wyden is terrific from Oregon, but he's so afraid of making waves because he'll lose his security clearance that when push comes to shove, he tends to back off. In the House, it's the Tea Party. If you can imagine that, because of this civil liberties issue that keeps popping up. Regarding Reality Winner, though, this is a real setback. I was hoping, and I actually allowed myself to believe that Trump would not continue this war on transparency that Obama had begun, and I guess I was wrong. Now I would have told Reality Winner what I have told other would-be whistleblowers who have approached me. The gravest mistake that I made was not speaking with an attorney before blowing the whistle. Mm-hmm. And again, I had to be reactive because once I went on TV and said the CIA is torturing its prisoners, the entire weight of the U.S. government fell on my head. And I really wish I had had legal advice before giving that interview. That's what I tell every person who comes to me and says they're thinking of blowing the whistle on wrongdoing.
And in her case, a lawyer and a pet sitter, right? Gosh.
Yes.
So, you know, to be ripped from the familiar weaving of your life. Well, yeah, you know, what you say about, you know, and I don't know, do you know Bruce Fein? Do you know who Bruce Fein is?
Oh, Bruce is not just one of my dearest friends. He's also one of my attorneys.
Oh, that's adorable. Of course you know him. Right. So were you part of the Committee for the Republic? Did you present there?
I did.
In this? Okay, well, that's where we met. Okay, that's one of the places we met, as well as Code Pink, which is a good reach. It's a good reach.
As well as Code Pink.
Well, you know, I value the Committee for the Republic, and I'm sort of, you know, I don't know, they have me as their Celtic coyote. But because I do know sane Tea Party people, and I've been on panels with Bruce Fine, right? And he's kind of playful, although he did say somebody called him the Mick Jagger of constitutional law, and I said that's good, and he said with a straight face, really meaning it, he goes, who's Mick Jagger? I'm like, oh my god,
yeah.
he really is James Madison. He's back in the 19th century.
He can quote Plutarch, but he doesn't own a television.
Right, no, it's adorable. Okay, so Bruce Fine is interesting because we were on a panel, or they were on a panel as founding fathers at CPAC. I went to CPAC because I'll go anywhere. And I have met, you know, again, well, are there allies? Are there parts of people that are allies, as you say, Bruce Fine? Constitutional lawyer. Do you call him a right-wing constitutional lawyer or a libertarian?
He's so hard to pigeonhole. I call him a libertarian. Because he has this very pure belief in the Constitution, where political parties and political ideologies truly mean nothing to him. He cares only about the Constitution and about the rule of law, and I have such deep respect for that.
Right, and then also with the other Committee for the Republic, Judge Tuttle, you know, working for Guantanamo,
right.
You know, there's quirky allies, you know, everywhere, and again that the unusual alliance, and that's, oh, we're waning too soon. I'm gonna have to have you come back here, but it's your capacity for ambiguity and nuance that did stand you in good stead in prison, right, where you're
It really did. And, you know, sometimes it was silly. For example, this rumor got started just before my arrival in prison that I had been a hitman for the CIA. And the Aryans thought that was great. And so I was out on the yard one day, and one of the chief Aryans, they called them shot callers, one of the Aryan shot callers approached me and said, "Hey, I wanted to talk to you. Is it true that you were a hitman at the CIA?" And, you know, of course I wasn't. But this is the head of the Aryans. And so I said, "Listen, it was wartime, and we all did things we weren't proud of."
Oh, wow.
And all he said was, "Awesome." And he walked away.
Right. And so you were safe. Wait, but you sat at their table for a year.
I did. I sat at the Aryan table for a year because I was what they called good. My paper was good, which means I was not a rat and not a child molester. And so I was A-OK with the Aryans until finally the Italians, and when I say Italians, I mean
yes.
Italians named Gambino, Bonanno, Lucchese, you get the idea. One of the Bonanno captains approached me and said, "Hey, let me ask you a question. Why do you sit with those Nazi retards in the cafeteria?" And I said, I don't know. When I first arrived here, they said, "Sit with us." And he said, very dramatically, he puts his finger in the air and he says, "From today, you're with the Italians."
Wow, right. And then also you had the black Muslim coming to you saying, Reverend Farrakhan says you're a hero to Muslims, so you're good with us. Oh, this is all too fleeting. I hope I can invite you back, John.
I would love it. Thank you so much for having me.
No, this is a great pleasure. Thank you so much. And we've barely even touched the book. We're going to have you back as soon as we can.
Wonderful.
That's wonderful. So thanks so much, John Kiriakou. His website, johnkiriakou.com. Thanks very much to Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. Maybe I'll see some of you Wednesday night at Open Secret, 7 p.m., or June 23rd, Commonweal in Bolinas. Remember, better a trickster than a martyr be, coyotenetworknews.com. Thank you all so much. Woof.
Oh, yeah,
man in America concerned himself, since we've been away from the African continent for 400 years, 300 or 400 years. Why should we concern ourselves? What impact does what happened to them have upon us? Number one,
I'm Gentleman Destiny.
For news, information, and analysis about Africa and the African diaspora, tune in weekly on Mondays at 7 p.m. to Africa Today with your host, Walter Turner. Africa Today is your source for being up to date on Africa and Africans. Mondays at 7 p.m., Africa Today on your Pacifica radio station, KPFA 94.1 FM.
South Bay Contra invites you to our monthly Contra Dance featuring the live fiddle tunes of String Fire Band and Calling by Gene Gibson Corindo from Los Osos. The Contra Dance takes place from 2:30 to 6 p.m. on Sunday, July 16th at First Unitarian Church of San Jose, 160 North 3rd Street, San Jose. No experience or partner needed, and all ages are welcome. This event is wheelchair accessible and is a benefit for Bay Area Country Dance Society and First Unitarian Church of San Jose. For more information, call 408-341-9123 or www.bacds.org/SBC. No experience or partner needed, and all ages are welcome. 408-341-9123.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 8.